Thank you very much. That was incredible. So we have about 10 minutes or so for questions. So if you're holding on to any cards, find an usher and do send them forward. So we'll begin with a question for Dr. Trachtenberg here. Someone wants to know if you could elaborate on the State Department definition of anti-Semitism. When was it adopted? What president or administration was in power when that happened? Was it done via congressional action? And was it done without public knowledge?
I'll do my best to answer that. Yeah, I don't know all the specifics of it. I think it began around 2009, so during the last administration. And it was an appropriation of this working definition that had been undertaken by this European monitoring group. And that was really just a working definition so that they could begin examining this phenomenon, trace anti-Semitism in Europe. But it became encoded into State Department policy, and you could actually go online, and I had actually peeked over your shoulder and saw that question, so I looked it up. If you just go to the State Department website, you'll see it. And the primary definition isn't particularly offensive in any way. It says anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews, which seems fairly straightforward. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed towards Jewish or non-Jewish individuals, their property, and so on. The problem becomes, so that in itself seems fine to me. The problem is where they give you the examples of what contemporary anti-Semitism is. And the first few are fine. It's about demonizing Jews, making stereotypical allegations of Jews, and so on. But then where it starts going, saying things like accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide. And then there's a whole section on anti-Semitism related to Israel. And this is where that speech of exceptionalism begins to be encoded into policy. And if the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act goes through, it'll be encoded into law. And it has these, what we call the three Ds. It's about demonizing Israel, applying a double standard for Israel, and delegitimizing Israel. And so it says that if you use symbols that are associated with classic anti-Semitism to characterize Israel or Israelis, I tend to agree with that. But then has other comparisons which are totally, in my mind, illegitimate, such as drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. But this happens, of course, all the time among Jews. You know, I've been called a capo. You hear Israelis talking to one another, accusing one another of acting like Nazis in all sorts of ways. So what they're saying is Jews can say things to Jews, but non-Jews can't say those things to Jews without somehow being anti-Semitic and thus a violation of law. And this is where that problem of exceptionalism comes in. Such comparisons began even prior to the creation of the State of Israel. There's this famous letter that Albert Einstein and others signed when I think it was Moshe Dayan came to the United States. He, Hannah Arendt, and others declared that he's a fascist and he shouldn't be allowed into the United States, making a clear comparison. So they're writing this, in 47, with the tragedy that had just occurred in Europe. So they're making these comparisons. So Jews have been doing this really, since the beginning of Nazism, making this kind of comparison. Interestingly, at the very end, there's this little caveat, and it's in italics, it's set aside from the rest of the definition. It says, however, criticism of Israel similar to that leveled against any other country cannot be regarded as anti-Semitic. So as long as you're criticizing other countries along with Israel, it's okay. But if you choose to sort of focus your attention on Israel, somehow it's anti-Semitic, which is like saying that if you're an organization that is trying to defend the human rights of North Koreans, and that's the focus of your organization, somehow you're anti-Korean for doing so, because you're just having a focus on one country. So again, they're insisting on this exceptionalism aspect to this code.
Thank you. A question for Dr. Abdelhadi. So someone wants to know the extent to which the Canary Mission has intimidated students on campus, and if you have noticed in your classroom and on campus a reduction in students willing to speak out for fear that it could jeopardize their career going forward.
Yes, Canary Mission has. The good news is that Twitter has took down the Canary Mission account. So at least we know that there are some people that are holding folks to the same kind of accountability. But it wasn't just Canary Mission. Canary Mission has definitely intimidated and scared people on campus. It also is the various ways in which the what I call the Israeli lobby industry within campus is working, in the sense that now students can't even find rooms to reserve. Time when we want to have events, now the new head of risk management on campus is our main resident Zionist on campus. So now they forced the college to ensure the room where we had an event, Palestine at San Francisco State on February 7th, which was the first time in 11 years of my being at San Francisco State that that conference room of the college gets insured. First time. And I objected before it happened, and I said, this is constructing us as dangerous people. When you're saying student safety, why is student safety being endangered? Actually, we never had problems. People love. Our only problem is we have too many people. We don't have enough space on campus. Sometimes we have to go out to the yard to have events. So why is this being constructed? And now, and what this means is that now every single event that's going to happen in the College of Ethnic Studies also has to be insured, in order for them to show that there is no disparate treatment. So yes, it's been really, really difficult. We've had rooms that were canceled. Students are very afraid to speak up. Last week, one of the students had an argument in one of the classes about Zionism, and the Zionist student went and complained to the administration that they'd made her uncomfortable. And as a result, the student was called to the chair's office, and she actually had to go with a lawyer from Palestine Legal because she did not know what's going to happen, because students are being prosecuted left and right, even though that independent investigation came out saying that there was nothing anti-Semitic, there was no violence involved in the Nir Barkat protest. Nonetheless, the university, 2 days after the lawsuit was filed on June 19th, on June 22nd or 23rd, came out with a statement saying that the Nir Barakat events shows the ugly face of anti-Semitism. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. But the only way it makes sense is because San Francisco State University has only now one-third of funding from the state of California. So rather than going to the state back and saying fund education, what they are doing is they're relying on donors, private donors. And so this is the defunding of the education. So the university becomes accountable to the donors who say we're going to give you $1.5 million in Kuwait Foundation funds and take it away if you don't discipline Palestinian students, if you don't stop the program, and so on. So all of this stuff is actually making it very difficult. So it's not just the Canary Mission. The point is that it's actually much bigger than that. And they are, and one of the ways that we're demanding is transparency, transparency and accountability. Let's get all of this stuff in the spotlight, and let's see who is actually following the law, and who's violating the law, and who's trying to silence us, and if we are really wrong about our insistence on justice-centered knowledge production. Let's put it out there, and when we put it out in public space, people support, as we know this is what's going on. Thank you.
So now we have a question for Barry again. Do you believe in the concept of hate speech? Is it ever a good idea for the government to police hate speech? So elaborate on that.
Well, I'm not a free speech expert or hate speech expert. I mean, I do think there is hate speech, certainly. When it's targeted against particular groups based on racial identity, ethnic identity, sexual identity, I mean, I think there's many categories of that. And I think that it makes sense for universities to be always debating these subjects. I'm concerned about codes of speech, although I think there's times where they're necessary, such as what we've been seeing, you know, we saw in Charlottesville, for example. It shouldn't be allowed on college campuses. But I think these are really, really tricky questions, and it's very, very hard to identify often what hate speech is, especially in a case such as this one, where you have people who have instrumentalized speech against Israel and have been able to successfully make the case that it is a form of hate speech, and insisting on this association that Israel is the Jewish people, that Judaism is Zionism, when these things are not the case.
Rabab, a question. Have Palestinian professors across the country developed communication networks to try and coordinate a plan to counteract the Zionist campus message?
Can I answer that question and say something about Barry's question?
Of course.
Yeah. Feel free.
Yes, yes. There are networks. People can interact with each other. But as we know, there has been a very big blow to Palestinian solidarity organizing in the U.S., both because of the fear that the Israel lobby, and when I say Israel lobby, by the way, this is not a code name for Jewish organizations, because people think that this is not, as Barry has explained in his paper and as I've explained in many, many instances. But as a result of fear-mongering, as a result of targeting people's attacks and so on, we are in touch with each other, but it's not just Palestinians. I think it's really, really important to emphasize that the people who are working for justice in for Palestine are not only Palestinians, Arabs, or Muslims. This is not a special interest group. This is a question that involves justice. This is a question that affects all of us. It affects all of us who are involved in justice for in Palestine. And it involves all of us who are interested in maintaining our campuses as spaces for critical thinking, for debate, for learning, for not being scared every single time, feeling policed if you want to say something. It's really important for us to protect that. So it is not just about us. The whole McCarthyism is not about us. The stuff that's happening to professors across, it's not only about Palestinians. I think the problem is that in our imaginary, we think about Palestine in one part of our brains and we think about other things in other part. But we really need to think about them together. If we institute the framework of the indivisibility of justice, then we can see how these things are connected. And we have, at San Francisco State, the union, our union, twice passed resolution. Now it went to the San Francisco Labor Council that passed twice resolutions in supporting us. First time in history resolutions on Palestine. This is really important. This is really significant. And this connects the issue. The fact that young kids last Friday, Palestinian students weren't on campus, and I wasn't on campus. When President Wang's statement came out, it was other students who took it upon themselves to choke, to put on the ground Zionism, Zionists are not welcome, Zionism is racism. It wasn't us. It wasn't even Palestinians, Arabs, or Muslims. Our coalition includes people, Jewish Voice for Peace, practically live on campus. People from the 68 Strikers, people from Black Student Union and the Panthers, people from the Japanese community, Asian community, from poor working people, from Latinx communities. We have a huge coalition, and I think really, really important, I'm not going to do your question. But I think this is really important to think that one thing that I think we really need to remember is that the majority of the world community supports justice in for Palestine. And I think in the United States, because this is a world place to think about Palestine, because of the excessive support for Israel from the government, not the people, people do not realize that the people in the United States are joining the rest of the world community in supporting justice for in Palestine. And this is not an exception. The same thing happened during apartheid South Africa. It takes a while for people in this country to join, judging by who voted for the person in the White House. I mean, it's not rocket science, but there are more and more and more people saying no. This is not okay, and joining the world community. So I think it's really important to say we're not alone. Yes, we do get targeted, and it's very, very difficult, and it's really hard. But every single time you think about all the people who are struggling, all the people who are coming together, this is amazing coalition for justice. It gives you power. I think the most important thing is that people in Palestine are steadfast and refusing to move. They are staying put. They are experiencing what we call sumud in Palestine. And those of us who are in the rest of the world are also responding to that and working according to justice. So I think it's really important not to think only about Palestinians or Muslims or Arabs, but or Jews, but to think about a very broad community that comes together to build this indivisibility of justice.
All right, well, we're out of time, and I think that's a positive way to end the panel. But just to note, Dr. Abdelhadi and Noor Erekat will be signing their books by registration. Now it's time for lunch. Lunch will be served behind those doors as Grant runs over there. And we'll see you after lunch.